Well, it's my privilege to introduce to you today Dr. Daniel Bynes. I have great respect for Daniel Bynes, and I learned this very quickly after meeting him just a few years ago, and that is because it was shortly after meeting him for the first time that he became my wife's boss. And then I realized I need to respect him a whole lot. And in all seriousness, my respect for him is very sincere. Dr. Bynes has led a life that is a true inspiration. He is a devoted Christian, and he does not hesitate to advertise his faith with others. He is a family man. I have enjoyed getting to know his lovely wife, Melissa, as well as his three beautiful children. And so it is an inspiration to see him and his family so much in love with both God and with each other. Dr. Bynes has also created and runs an overtly Christian mental health center just up the street from where we are here at the Granite Bay Hilltop Church. In Auburn, California, he has created and runs a mental health clinic that is entitled Beautiful Minds. And indeed, right from the title, and walking into that clinic, you will very quickly experience a very positive experience, a very beautiful experience. And so it's a very fitting name for that particular clinic. Dr. Bynes is an extremely popular psychiatrist, and he's in great demand. In fact, I've been told more than once that one of the greatest frustrations that patients have in Auburn is trying to get an appointment with Dr. Bynes because he is just so popular and makes such a difference for good in the people of the lives of his patients. Again, the thing that I appreciate and many of his patients appreciate is that he and his clinic is very openly Christian. And they're not afraid to be able to share that faith, understanding that they want to approach mental health from a holistic approach, which includes a genuine faith and having the presence of God in the life of their patients. And so that is something that causes me to have great respect for Dr. Bynes. He is not your average psychiatrist, and that's what I've also heard from the feedback of different people that have experienced his care. I'm looking forward to your presentation here today, Dr. Bynes, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Sean. Appreciate you having me. All right. Well, it's wonderful to be here with all of you this afternoon. And shortly before I came up, I saw Pastor John Ross in the hallway, and I said, "How long do I have?" And he said, "Oh, don't worry about it. Take as long as you want. It seems like people are really interested in mental health things." Now, you'd think, you know, saying that to a psychiatrist is a pretty safe thing to say, right? What he doesn't know is that us psychiatrists, you know, even though in sessions we might be very quiet, tell me more, how does that make you feel? We take in so much that finally when it's our turn to speak, sometimes we can't stop. So you'll have to excuse me, or maybe, blame Pastor Ross if this goes a little long. But no, in all seriousness, I'm really glad to be here with you this afternoon, and it's a blessing to talk about mental health. So I wanted to share a little bit with you about my story and how I got into mental health. And then we're going to dive into that secret. And I'm sure you all are wondering, what is that ultimate secret? And how could he make such a presumptuous statement, the ultimate secret? Well, we're going to get to that here in just a few minutes. So hang tight. All right, so my story that I wanted to share with you, begins in Loma Linda. So Loma Linda University is in Southern California, and that's where I went to medical school. And as I went to medical school, I had a wonderful plan. And that plan was to become a surgeon. And I was going to come, I was going to become a general surgeon, and then I was even thinking about going into plastic surgery. And then I was going to go to Africa and become a missionary doctor. That was my plan. And I knew that that was where the Lord was leading me. Well, not so quick. Sometimes God changes our plans, right? You know, through medical school, I went through quite a journey myself. And we all have a journey, right? And it's beautiful how God is so patient with us. Well, during my journey, I struggled a lot. You know, I did okay academically, but I struggled with some of the friendships and some of the choices that I was making in medical school. And frankly, some of them were very poor choices. Well, towards the end of my 4-year medical school degree, I had just interviewed for surgery, and I was getting ready for what they call the match to get into my training program. And so at that point, I was actually got to a point where I was pretty down in the dumps. And I felt like, you know, I'm doing all these things. I'm like at the pinnacle where I'm about to graduate from medical school. I should be so happy. But I wasn't. Why was that? I'll tell you, the key was that I was not being spiritually fed. And so I actually went through a process where I wasn't ready to set foot into a church. I wasn't ready to open a Bible, but what I was ready to do was to open my heart to God in the sanctuary of nature. And so as I went out on these walks, and I went and spent time hiking up the mountain that was close to where I lived, Blue Mountain, I would pray. And as I was going through that process, I was trying to connect with God in a deeper way than I ever had before. And I went through a transformative experience where I started to taste what true peace, true satisfaction, true joy, true connection was all about. And as I experienced that, I said, you know what? I want something different than surgery. I realized that is not my calling. And it was one Sabbath morning, I was walking up this mountainside, and I was praying about my future, and the idea hit me. You want to be a doctor. What kind of doctor do you want to be? And I said, I want to be a doctor like Jesus. What kind of doctor work did Jesus do? Well, yes, he healed people physically, but even more importantly, he healed them spiritually and emotionally, right? And that's what I want to be a doctor like Jesus. And I was thinking, well, what's the closest thing in medicine? And then it hit me, psychiatry. Dealing with the mind, dealing with the heart. And so I called the Department of Psychiatry that next Monday, and I said, you know, I changed my mind. I want to go into psychiatry. And I was just jubilant. And the person on the other line paused, and she said, oh, okay. Well, unfortunately, we already finished all the interviews for the season. Oh, no, what am I going to do? But I knew the Lord had called me into mental health, into psychiatry. So I said, well, could you just please ask the program director to see if they would make an exception? And she said, okay, I will. And sure enough, she went and asked, and she said, okay, you know what? She called me back, and she said, we'll grant you an exception. We'll do an interview with you. And I think part of that was they wanted to see if I was mentally stable or not, since I had made such a dramatic change. So they did actually interview me. And normally you interview for, you know, 10, 15, sometimes 20 different programs. I only interviewed at one place because it was so late in the interview season. But you know, the Lord had a plan. And he knew that I needed to stay at Loma Linda. And I did. So I matched into psychiatry at Loma Linda, and that's how I ended up in psychiatry. And it was a wonderful experience. I learned a lot of spiritual things at the Loma Linda program. They have very spiritual emphasis. But the one thing I will say, and it's not a knock on Loma Linda, it's a knock on psychiatry as a whole, is that I was disappointed because I saw in the field of mental health that the focus was on what when it comes for us to psychiatry? Medicine, right? Yeah. What we call a pill for every ill, right? And I, frankly, after 2-3 years in psychiatry, I started to get discouraged in my training program. And I said, well, this is not what I signed up for. I want to really help people. I want to connect people with what will actually heal them. And I even had thoughts about adding a second residency in family medicine. And I applied for family medicine, but again, the Lord had other plans. And so it was at that point that I actually, some of you saw this guy earlier, yeah? That I actually met Dr. Neil Nedley. My wife's family has been family friends with them for many, many years. Actually, my father-in-law and Dr. Nedley were in residency together in Ohio at Kettering. And so I met him, and I had the opportunity to go to visit his 10-day residential depression recovery program. And what I saw astounded me. I had never seen the results of applying natural methods to bringing healing into people's lives. And I said, this is what I want to do. The proof's in the pudding. Natural means do make a huge difference. And so I said, you know what? I want to do this, but I want to do this not just for residential. I want to do this for outpatients. I want everybody to have access to this because this is such a needed thing to change the trajectory of people's lives. And that's where the idea came for Beautiful Minds Medical. So we founded Beautiful Minds Medical in 2011, and my wife, Melissa, who's here with our children right there in the back. Melissa, maybe you can wave. and she was so kind to work with me, and she was so patient, and she still is to this day, praise the Lord. And we started, it was just her and I. And she was doing the reception and the billing and everything, and I was doing the psychiatry. And so we started a small practice, and praise God, that practice has grown by leaps and bounds over the last 12 years. And that practice has been founded on treating the root causes for mental health instead of just treating the symptoms. Now, in that process, we also developed not only Beautiful Minds Medical, but Beautiful Minds Binus. Okay, here we go. All right, there they are. So praise God. Here's a picture of my family. We have three beautiful young children. And you might notice something about the youngest one there. No, she doesn't have hair on her face. She's a little bit shy. And so if you put her on the spot, she can be very shy. So what we have to do is we have to actually get her involved in health ministry. Here you see her with carrots, where she forgets about herself and she's involved in helping other people, right? So that's the youngest one, Elisa, doing some health ministry there, offering me some carrots. All right, so what's really amazing about when you treat root causes is, and we have a holistic program, this program actually works tremendously. So we see that more than 90% of depressed patients have a positive treatment response when they do that holistic intervention program, and this is in 2 to 3 weeks. 92% of patients who begin with high levels of anxiety leave with low to normal levels, and 67% of patients suffering with depression go into remission. That means they no longer qualify as even having depression before discharge from our intensive holistic program. And here you just see basically the same data from a graphical standpoint. And it's just wonderful. To me, the greatest joy, not just as a professional, as a psychiatrist, but as a human being, is to watch people get their lives back. Amen. To watch the light come back into their eyes, the joy back into their hearts, and see that they have hope again for the future. What a blessing. And I just want to let you know, if you want more resources, please feel free to visit our website, beautifulmindshealth.com. beautifulmindshealth.com. And if you are a podcaster, you like to listen to podcasts, we do have the Brain People podcast. And this is a podcast that is features myself and then three of my colleagues. Some of you might recognize Dr. Katie Elson. She was just married right here on this stage. That was a week, just less than a week ago. And then Amanda Anguish and then Jonathan Eden. So those are my wonderful colleagues. And we have a lot of fun doing all sorts of mental health topics for the Brain People podcast. And so during my experience, I've kept track and I've paid attention, you know, how is it that these holistic sort of approaches help mental health? And so we've come up with an acronym called CHOOSE LIFE that encompasses these different elements of holistic intervention. So Choose Life stands for connection, hydration, optimism, oxygen, self-control, exercise, and light, and internal clock, food, and then the final E stands for environment. But the question in my mind that came up, so these are the root issues that we need to address, right? Are there any particular roots that are more important than any of the other ones? What do you think? Do you think there might be one of these that could actually be more important from the scientific data that is shown than any of the other ones? Remember, we're talking about the ultimate solution here, right? What would you guess if you had to choose, not life, but choose one of these? They're all important. Well, let's find out. This is where it gets exciting. All right, so the Harvard Study of Adult Development. This was an old study that went on for years, 1938. They looked at sophomores at Harvard at that time, and then they also had a group, boys from the poorest areas in Boston. And so obviously some of these were the preppy, well-to-do Harvardites, and then the other ones were very poor. And they wanted to follow these individuals, and they actually followed them for more than 80 years and did extensive testing and interviewing. They wanted to find out what were the issues that made a difference for these people in the long term when it came to their health. Well, what they found, and here you see a picture of somebody at the age of 19, 47, and then 82, right? Those who were socially disconnected had more depression, experienced earlier cognitive decline, and died sooner. Listen to this. Those who were the most, satisfied with their relationships at the age of 50 were the healthiest at the age of 80 and lived longer. So those who were the most satisfied with their relationships at the age 50 were the healthiest at age 80 and lived longer. Connection has tremendous health impacts. It actually impacts neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to change and heal, and gene expression, the way that our genes are expressed. How many of you have ever heard of the term epigenetics? Yeah? Epigenetics basically, so we all have a set of genes, but there's different environmental factors, like if we exercise or what kind of food we eat or our stress levels, that actually determine which genes are turned off or on. We call that the field of epigenetics. And what we find is when we have close connection, healthy relationships, that the good genes are actually turned on and the not so good genes tend to be turned off. Isn't that amazing? Loneliness is equivalent to what? Smoking 15 cigarettes per day. Pastor Doug just earlier today was talking about how, you know, cigarette smoking by itself, if we wanted to cut down on and solve that health crisis, then that would alleviate the problem right there. But I'm here to tell you that we have another big health crisis that we're not really thinking about, another problem that we're not always addressing, which is lack of connection. That's another big one that we need to address. It's worse for your health than obesity or high blood pressure. Amazing, isn't it? When you start thinking about that, it's like, wow. And how often do you hear health lectures on connection? We talk a lot about food. We talk a lot about exercise. We talk a lot about water and all these wonderful things, which are important. But so is connection. In fact, it's the most important. Socially disconnected people are less happy, their health declines earlier in midlife, their brain functioning declines sooner, and they live shorter lives than people who are not lonely. That's Robert Waldinger, Harvard Study of Adult Development. So, I just want to run through a few studies that I think are very interesting and somewhat entertaining about the importance of connection. So, enough to give you an ulcer. So, 8,500 men with no history of duodenal ulcer were studied for 5 years. So, this was a prospective study, and 254 developed ulcers. Those who reported a low level of perceived, And that word is very important. Perceived love and support from who? Their wives had over twice as many ulcers as the other men. Those men who answered, "My wife actually does not love me," had almost three times as many ulcers. Now, men, if you get an ulcer, I'm not saying that it's okay to blame your wife, right? Because it actually could be a cognitive distortion. Remember, we heard about cognitive distortions earlier today. Sometimes it's actually not even true. Sometimes our wives love us very much, but we don't actually perceive how much they love us. Perception is often everything. And interestingly enough, there was actually another study that was very similar where they were looking at chest pain. And they found that those men who did not perceive that their wife actually loved them very much, at least, had much higher levels of chest pain. And those that did were actually a lot more protected from developing chest pain, even when they had high risk factors like high cholesterol, obesity, hypertension, etc. Here's an interesting community-based study. So there was three towns, Roseto, Bangor, and Nazareth. And so they looked at different mortality risk factors and all these different things. And so basically, they wanted to compare these three towns. So they Roseto is in Pennsylvania. It's an Italian-American town. And they saw that the risk factors for heart disease were at least as high compared to neighboring communities of Bangor and Nazareth. All the three communities served by the same hospital, the water supply, and the same physicians. So the question was, why was the incidence of heart attacks so much lower in Roseto? And it's very interesting, right? Because you think about the Italian way of life, you know, the Italian food, right? Is that the most healthy food? No, right? I mean, I guess it depends what kind of Italian food you eat, but generally speaking, we're thinking about oftentimes very high refined pastas and breads and pizzas and then lots of wine, right? And didn't we learn earlier that those are not so good for our health? Yeah, so why was it? And that's why they say risk factors were at least as high, right? So the difference was the community. There was cohesive community and family relationships. Now, what was interesting is that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, they actually lost much of that community cohesion. And guess what happened? The heart attack mortality rose to the same level as those other two towns. Very interesting, right? Again, that connection made a huge difference. They've done many different studies. 1979 to 1994, for example, there was 8 large-scale community-based studies. They found that those that are socially isolated at least 2 to 5 times the risk of premature death from all causes when compared to those who had a strong sense of connection and community. And here's an interesting study where they actually looked at beta blockers, which are a very commonly prescribed medication. And they found that in the process, they actually weren't looking at this, but they were looking at different risk factors, et cetera. And they found that those that were socially isolated and having a high degree of life stress were more than 4 times the risk of death. This effect on premature death was much more powerful than the beta blocker drug being tested. So again, oftentimes we focus on meds being the solution, but there's so much more to the story. And these holistic things that we're talking about, they are actually much more powerful than medication because they get to the core issues. Oftentimes, the heart problems we have, the diabetes we have, the cancer that we get are related not just to peripheral lifestyle, but often even related to loneliness, unmanaged stress, depression, anxiety, all of those things are very connected. And that's why we need to, when we talk about dealing with health, we need to address the whole person. And then here, breast cancer survival. In 1989, Dr. David Spiegel and colleagues at Stanford did a study. And his intention was to disprove, he was sick of people talking about how social connection can do this and that. He said, you know what, that's a bunch of mumbo jumbo. That's not going to affect cancer. His intention was to disprove the idea that psychosocial interventions could prolong life of women with breast cancer. So he decided to do a prospective study where they would randomly assign two groups. Both received the best medical care. But there was one difference. One group met together for 90 minutes once a week for a year. And this is a very interesting response from Dr. Spiegel. He said, 5 years later, I finally got around to looking at the data and I almost fell off my chair. Those women who had the weekly support group lived on average twice as long as did the other group. In fact, all the women in the comparison group were dead at 5 years. And interestingly enough, there was another study that they did at UCLA where they actually did an intervention for people with malignant melanoma. And these individuals, they did a similar intervention where they had a support group once a week, but guess what? Instead of it being a year long, it was only 6 weeks long. And these individuals actually survived three times, had a three times more survival rate than those that were not part of that 6 week intervention. And it was just once a week for 6 weeks. Isn't that amazing? The power of connectedness, the power of knowing that you are not alone, the power of knowing it's okay to open up, to share the burdens on my heart. I don't have to carry those alone. Isn't that important? And don't we need to get better at creating that space in our families, in our communities, in our churches? And I love this one, man's best medicine. Patients recently hospitalized with a heart attack or chest pain. After 1 year, only 6% of pet owners died compared to what? 28% of patients who did not own pets. So even pets can have a tremendous difference. And another study, the effect of a dog on lowering blood pressure reactivity was even greater than the presence of a good friend, since the friend was often perceived as judgmental, but the dog was not. You gotta love that, right? Your dog doesn't care if your hair is all kind of crazy or if you smell bad or even if you give him a frown or a grimace, but we feel like we have to kind of, you know, put it together when we're around people. It is a blessing to be in the presence of a human being or an animal where we know we are accepted just as we are. And giving or receiving. A study on 700 elderly people showed that the effects of aging had more to do with what they contributed to their social support network than what they received from it. Jesus himself said what? It is more blessed to give than to receive. Well, here we have the scientific proof, and we don't need science to prove Jesus right, but it's just sometimes science has to catch up with Jesus, right? And that's the way all true science, we find, always supports what the Bible says. And if something contradicts, some scientific experiment contradicts what God's word says, we know that that was bad science. I say that with unabashedly no apology. Amen. It's the absolute truth. And again, we have seen that in the history of science. Dr. Dean Ornish, it's not Onrush, it's Ornish. He actually wrote a book called Love and Survival. He was one of the first people that did, he was an internal medicine physician, and he did many experiments, and he was one of the first to show that you can actually reverse heart disease. So he put together a very holistic heart disease intervention program. And at the end of all these years and studies, this is the conclusion that he came to, and it's a beautiful conclusion. He says, I'm not aware of any other factor in medicine, not diet, not smoking, not exercise, not stress, not genetics, not drugs, not surgery, that has a greater impact on our quality of life, incidence of illness, and premature death from all causes than does what? Love and intimacy. And this was a guy that was a very science-focused guy, brilliant man, and he came to that conclusion. He's not a psychiatrist, internal medicine doctor. And he learned, not only through this process, how important it is for others, but when you read his book, you see how much of an effect that had had on his own growth as a human being as well. Pastor Doug mentioned this earlier, the five blue zones where people reach age 100 at 10 times greater rates than in the United States. Well, in the United States, except that is in Loma Linda, California, which, as Pastor Doug mentioned earlier, has a very high proportion of Seventh-day Adventists because they're practicing this health message. Now, what's really interesting, when you look at the 9 factors for longevity, because in the Blue Zone studies, they break it down to 9 different factors. And sure, some are really important, like regular physical activities and optimal nutrition. But 5 of the 9 factors are actually what? Related to connectedness. Loved ones first. Downshift. In other words, slow down, right? And when you slow down, what happens? You have more time to connect. You're not running all around like a chicken with your head cut off, which sometimes I feel like, right? Right tribe. So you're hanging out with people that also want the same thing you want, right? A sense of purpose, and then a sense of belonging. All right, before I jump to this. So the question is, what is the mediating factor? Why is connection so important? What is it about connection that changes our bodies in such a dramatic way? And yes, even our minds and our hearts and who we are that actually brings such tremendous healing and health. Well, science is only beginning to understand the power of connection. But one of the most important aspects that they found through research, through data, is what they call the love hormone. Have any of you heard of that one? What's the name of that one? Oxytocin, right? So what they found with oxytocin is originally they thought it was just to stimulate labor and milk ejection, because when women go into labor, then there's a lot more oxytocin, and that helps with the uterine contractions and also then the milk letdown reflex. But they found subsequently that oxytocin does a whole lot more. It can induce anti-stress-like effects, such as reduction of blood pressure and cortisol levels. It increases pain thresholds. It exerts an anxiolytic-like effect and stimulates various types of positive social interaction. And in addition, it promotes growth and healing. Numerous studies show that it decreases cancer growth, it decreases fat production, it lowers blood pressure, increases bone growth, increases muscle growth. It decreases levels of osteoarthritic pain. It improves leaky gut. Actually, what's really interesting is that when the mother secretes milk and the baby's drinking the mother's milk, oxytocin is actually released into the milk. And then the baby gets to, of course, partake of that milk, and the oxytocin helps to form that healthy intestinal barrier, and it helps to create that healthy microbiome for the baby to flourish. It decreases pain, and it's cardioformative, cardioprotective, and cardiorestorative. So love, connection, truly is good for the heart, isn't it? Now this is an amazing study to me. And I know for you it's like, okay, what in the world is he trying to show here with these little guys running? What this is actually showing, so on the left you see the mesenchymal stem cell pool. So we all have stem cells, okay? And those stem cells will differentiate into different things. And when we're injured, for example, we hope that our stem cells will spring into action. And let's say, for example, that we break a bone, okay? So then when we break a bone, our hope is that our stem cells will actually form what? New bone cells. So they'll differentiate into new bone cells so that bone can be repaired. What they have found is that when there's inadequate levels of oxytocin present, when there's not enough oxytocin, guess what happens to those stem cells? Do they turn into bone? No. They actually turn into what? What are adipocytes? Those are fat cells. So they get lazy and they just turn into big fat blobs. On the other hand, when oxytocin is present, when love is present, guess what happens? Those same stem cells turn into bone cells. Now, when you think about the implications of that, that is tremendous. Have you ever heard that love heals? It does. Look at this. This tells us that if love is present, if we have a sense of connection when we're injured and we're weak and we need help, then we will be able to heal because the very fibers of our being, whether it's bone cells or heart cells or brain cells, will actually differentiate and become what they need to become for healing. Isn't that beautiful? And the other piece is it shows us that love motivates, right? Because you see that one, the adipocyte one, is just kind of blah, sit there. Love motivates to move, to build, to change, to grow. Beautiful, beautiful. So you're all thinking, okay, well, if oxytocin's so great, why don't we just take a supplement of it? Just put it in the water, right? But the research actually shows it's not that simple. We always want to just deduce it to a simple supplement, right? Just make it easy. Just give me a pill so I can get that connection benefit. I don't want to take the time to actually sit down and talk with my wife, you know, or a friend. Or, you know, it's like, no, God has made it so that we cannot get the benefit unless we actually spend the time. And you know, Satan is trying, we're going to talk about that in just a minute. Satan's trying to rob us of that time. The effects of oxytocin are context dependent and altered by experience. What they've actually shown is that when it comes to early life adversity, for example, like if you have trauma early on in life, sometimes when oxytocin is released, people can actually become more aggressive. They can become more defensive. And this is why people that have been traumatized early on in life, they often will run from relationships because it doesn't feel so good. Does that make sense? Why they actually get defensive? Because when they start feeling vulnerable, it's a danger signal. And what might stimulate a sense of positive connection and those fuzzy warm feelings in most of us for people that have been traumatized will actually do the opposite in them. And also under periods of high stress, if oxytocin is released or given during high periods of stress, again, it can actually have the opposite effect. And you can understand why that might be as well, because think about it this way. Let's say that your family is being threatened, right? And that oxytocin is actually being released under that period of stress. Then that oxytocin will make us want to better guard our family, protect them. Do you see what I'm saying? So it actually can be beneficial in some respects, but it helps us see that supplementing with a bunch of oxytocin is just not going to do it. And then the other piece that's really important to understand is if we get overstimulation of oxytocin, anything done in excess is what? It's harmful, right? It actually downregulates our oxytocin receptors. And what we see is when people engage in addictions, that this actually overstimulates the oxytocin and the dopamine system, downregulates those receptors, and then people can't even appreciate real life relationships. And the same would happen if we just supplemented with oxytocin, right? We would get that overstimulation, and it might feel good temporarily, but then over the long run, it wouldn't help so much. So we're all, you know, a definition of a pandemic is something that is occurring, you know, in multiple areas, and it's increasing in proportion. And we're seeing that, the COVID pandemic's not the only one. Dr. Nedley talked about the mental illness pandemic, and that's true. And a big part of that is because we have a pandemic of loneliness. Here we see a graphical chart where we see that a lot more people are spending time alone since 2013. And this was even before COVID. It was on the rise. And what's really interesting is that a lot of people actually, even during COVID, were living with other individuals, but many of those people, even if they were cohabiting with other individuals, felt very alone. So it's not just about being with a bunch of people. You can be what? Lonely in a crowd, right? You can be lonely in a crowd. And so even all of us, we could be sitting here surrounded by, so it's not as much about the number of people we know, the number of people we talk to, it's about our perception, the connection that we experience. Isolation is becoming the norm. Many developed countries are starting to realize how bad loneliness is for the country as a whole. Even shortly before the COVID pandemic, the New York Times published a series of articles on loneliness. In 2018, Britain appoints the Minister of Loneliness. And in 2021, Japan followed suit. And people are asking, does every country actually need a Minister of Loneliness? So Harvard did a study, and the title here says, a new report suggests that over 1 in 3 Americans face serious loneliness during the pandemic, including over 60% of young adults. The key findings of this report said that more than 1 in 3, 36% of respondents reported serious loneliness, feeling lonely frequently or almost all the time or all the time. This included 61% of young people aged 18 to 25 and 51% of who? Mothers with young children. Did you know that there's a lot of mothers? They have children. They're connected with their children, and yet they can still be what? Very lonely. It can be a very lonely time for young mothers. And so, you know, just something to tuck away. If you know a mother with young children, don't assume that she's too busy to want you to connect with her. Pause. Take the time. About half of lonely young adults in our survey reported that no one in the past few weeks, no one had taken more than just a few minutes to ask how they are doing in a way that made them feel like the person genuinely cared. No one, not their parents, grandparents, teachers, friends. Isn't that sad? Young adults suffer high rates of both loneliness and anxiety and depression. According to a recent CDC survey, 63% of this age group are suffering significant symptoms of anxiety and or depression. So here, this just, again, highlights a few of the dangers of low social connection. And now we're going to shift into connection killers, connection killers. So what are some of these things that are getting in the way of us connecting? What's interesting, I mentioned this earlier, but I want to reiterate a little bit deeper. So relational imposters, anything addicting. So basically, if you look at this circuit right here, we call the reward circuit. What we understand for this is this part of the brain is stimulated with any addictive behavior. So that can be alcohol, it can be a food addiction, it can be drugs, smoking, you know, you fill in the blank, we can be addicted to almost anything. But what's really interesting is that this reward circuit is also stimulated when it comes to relationships. And so if this reward circuit is not being adequately and appropriately stimulated with good things, like relationships, and also, you know, positive activities, etc., then guess what we're going to do? We're going to have a sense of loneliness, of emptiness, and we're going to start looking for other things to fill that void. And so, again, the problem is, though, when you do something addicting, does that really help you feel better in the long run? No, it makes you feel temporarily better, and you get that false sense of connection, that, and you do actually even get oxytocin released. But in the end, we get a letdown because there's no real connection. We feel more empty and even worse than we did at the first. What about social media? Does this help? Facebook internal research team blog post points to several research studies that establish, beyond the shadow of a doubt, they want you to think, that when used properly, social media makes people measurably happy. Study one, around 1,900 Facebook users found that when users received information written by someone they know well, they felt better. When receiving information from someone they didn't know well, the feeling was neutral. Okay, brilliant study. And then study two, during a 1 week period, one group were asked to make more Facebook posts than normal, while the control group was given no instructions. The experimental group reported less loneliness than the controls during this week. They felt more connected to their friends on a daily basis. So this is why we have to be careful of science, my friends. Remember, who was the one that did this study? Facebook did this study. You always have to ask yourself, who funded this study? Okay, so of course, if you get some more posts, that makes you feel a little better, right? If you do some blogging, whatever, you're connecting with people, and yeah, you feel a little happy. Now, on the other hand, study one, researchers at the University of Pittsburgh, so now we're talking more independent data, right? Found that the more subjects use social media, what? The more likely they were to be lonely. Study two, 5,200 subjects studied associations between Facebook activity and self-reported measures of physical health, mental health, and life satisfaction. Our results show that overall, the use of Facebook was negatively associated with well-being. So who do you believe? The studies that found positive results focused on specific behaviors of social media users. Negative studies focused on the net results of overall use of these media platforms. Holly Shakya, a researcher at UC San Diego, in an NPR interview said, "We have evidence that replacing your real-world relationships with social media use is detrimental to your well-being." So that's it right there. Social media does not make up for real-life relationships. Does that make sense? We cannot replace it. We need that in-person, face-to-face connection. And I'm not trying to say you can never use social media again, but again, it does not replace the real deal. And here we see more like, look at that loneliness graph, and this is in young people. And do you see that when the iPhone was released in 2007, you see that little mark right there? And do you see where the graph goes after that? It goes up quite steeply, doesn't it? And you see, especially around that 2011, 2012 mark that Dr. Nedley mentioned that earlier today, that over half of Americans started owning a smartphone. This is where you really see that loneliness take off. And then again, adversity in childhood. So the more adverse experiences people have in childhood, things like neglect, physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, living in a house with domestic violence, having an incarcerated parent, or other traumatic events like divorce, all of these factors, the more these factors people have, the more likely they are to, of course, be traumatized. And that, in turn, goes towards addiction. And that, in turn, disconnection, right? So all these factors are related. So this is another connection killer. And again, when we have that adversity in childhood, it actually makes our whole oxytocin system work differently so that even when we come close, maybe some of you have experienced this or some of you know somebody like this, when we try to come close to them, it's almost like, no, you know, it's scary, right? Being vulnerable, because I'm going to get hurt again. And then another connection killer are communication deficits. And of course, when we talk about communication, we're talking about not only verbal communication, which we need to learn, but also nonverbal. And praise God, you know, I'm not always, you'd think that I'd be really good at nonverbal communication as a psychiatrist, but I'm so grateful that I get feedback from my wife that helps me improve my nonverbal communication as well. And we're losing a lot of that because we spend so much time often just glued to a screen, even at work, etc., that our mirror neurons are becoming flat. We're losing empathy. We're losing the facial expressions, and our facial expressions are actually becoming more flat. It's very interesting. And then touch. This is something that we've become kind of almost a little allergic to in our society because we're so afraid of touching. We might be accused of sexual harassment or something like this. And I'll tell you, I think a big part of the over-sexualization in our society, in our culture, is because we don't touch enough in non-sexual ways. Because we're yearning for that connection. And so people then turn to you know, pornography, et cetera, because they're not receiving that healthy touch, the hugs, the joy of just being close without any expectations in that direction. And then what about the cult of busyness? The cult of busyness. So when we talk about busyness, you know, that's something that can really get in the way. And I'll tell you, when it comes to busyness, the research actually shows that the more busy we are, why do we get so busy? It's oftentimes because that feeds our ego, because it feeds our sense of self-worth. I must be important if I'm so busy, right? And it actually even affects how other people view us. It becomes a bit of a status symbol. Oh, they're so busy. That must mean they're really important, right? And so we get a lot of that self-worth from that. And then besides that, a lot of times we stay busy because then we don't have time to think. And it's also becomes an addiction where we numb ourselves instead of really dealing with those issues of the heart. So I want to close in this last part. I'm not going to close quite yet. So remember, Pastor Ross told me I could talk as long as... Don't worry, I won't keep you here all afternoon. But let's touch on a few pathways to connection. So in 2021, that Harvard report that I brought up earlier, what were their key recommendations? Well, there were three main key recommendations. They said, provide people with information and strategies. Build not just our physical, but our social infrastructure, and work to restore our commitments to each other. So what does that look like? Well, information and strategies. Number one, we need to learn to communicate. If you want to connect, you have to learn to communicate. And remember, communication is not just words, but it's also our facial expressions, our nonverbal communication, and it's touch too, right? And a lot of times, and this is something we don't have time to delve into, some of these communication keys, but one that is very simple is you can look this up too, I statements versus you statements. Has anyone ever heard of I statements? Okay, I'll give you just a simple example. You know, when we say like, why do you always do that? Or you're making me so angry right now. Or, you know, it's this, what does that do? Or when I say, you're a jerk, what does that do to you? It makes you what? Defensive, shut down. On the other hand, if it's the same scenario, but I say, I feel really hurt right now, or I feel unsafe right now, or I'm kind of angry right now, I'm sad. What happens there? Does that make you feel defensive? No, what does that do? That actually makes you curious. Well, why are you sad? Why are you upset? Why are you angry? You see how that makes you actually want to come closer instead of becoming defensive. So simple things like this can go a long ways in actually facilitating communication. We need to get off the phone. That's a huge one, right? And Dr. Nedley mentioned earlier today the importance of a daily digital Sabbath, time away from the phone, connecting with those that we care about. We need to remember to touch. And this is something I'm working on. You know, my wife is Latin American descent, Argentinian descent. And so in their culture, they touch a lot. Now, I'm German, right? So I'm like more like, nice to meet you. Herr Schmidt, yes. So this is an interesting study. I couldn't help but share this. Okay. So they did a study where they actually... They were looking at the number of times couples touched themselves, or not touched themselves, touched each other, touched each other. Let me emphasize that, touched each other in a coffee shop, okay? So they did this in several different countries, and they were observing, and they wanted to see in what countries do they actually touch each other more often. Just, you know, this is non-sexual, just, okay, just touching each other. What was the number one country? I gave it away. It was actually Puerto Rico, 180 an hour. Okay, so what was the next one after that? It was actually Paris, and I don't know how many countries they went to, 110 an hour. Now, what was the next one after that? United States is at 2 an hour. Now, don't worry, we weren't the lowest on the totem pole, okay? Guess where the lowest was? It wasn't Germany. It was actually London, 0. What a difference a small piece of water makes between France and London, right? Between France and England. So don't forget to touch, okay. Now, one important thing, when we're talking about people that have struggled with past hurt, we need to really think about helping them to feel safe. How do you do that? See, a lot of times we try to pressure them, well, you need to connect, you need to be in relationships. That's not the most important first step. The first step is to actually help them develop boundaries. So first you have to develop boundaries where you realize, like, you know what? I can say no. I have control over my life. And when people start having that sense of, like, more control over their life, I'm not going to be abused, I can step away from the situation anytime I want, they start to feel more safe in relationships. And then there's a wonderful book by Cloud and Townsend, who also wrote Boundaries as well, called Safe People. So then after they learn that boundaries can be developed, then they actually can learn how to identify safe people, because people that have been traumatized are naturally gravitate to people that are not healthy. And so it's really important to learn, you have to be very careful, you know, otherwise you're just going to repeat the same pattern of trauma over and over again. This is a beautiful thing, pain and grace. Did you know that oxytocin is actually released in response to pain? That is really important for us to understand. And this is where God's grace comes in. When we are in pain and we're struggling and we're suffering, even when we've been traumatized, God is actually, he allows oxytocin to be released. And through that process, we actually have the opportunity to connect on a deeper level, both with him and then with people that really care. And again, it shows us that healing power, that every time pain comes in, God's grace comes in and he says, yes, but I have a remedy, I have a solution, I have a path to healing. And then the second recommendation from Harvard, building social infrastructure, the third place. You know, in the past, we had a lot of third places. These are pictures of men in barbershops. And so, in the past, we had places, and when you say the first place in our life is our home, okay? Second place is where, usually? Work, right? And then the third place is another place in the community where people typically gather just to connect. And so it could be barbershops, it could be churches, etc. But we've lost a lot of that in our culture today. Usually now it's just home and work. And that's a problem. And so part of what we want to look at is actually creating more third places. And even churches are like open one day a week, right? What would it look like if we had more third places in our community? If this church was even more of a third place where people could just come and connect even throughout the week. And then finally, restoring our commitments. Again, the Harvard 2021 report, I love this quote, they said, our commitment that we need to restore is to renew a founding promise of this country, that we have commitments to ourselves, but we also have vital commitments to each other, including to those who are vulnerable. Think about that for a minute. What that means is that it's not just about me. It's not just about thinking about ourselves. And this is something we need to be very careful as Christians, because what are we typically concerned about as Christians? We're concerned about our own spiritual growth. We're our relationship with God, our character development. And while all those things are good, how do we actually even attain those? So we can get so self-focused, even in our spirituality, we forget about our commitments to other people, to those around us. And Jesus, when he comes again, what does he say when he separates the sheep and the goats? What is the big marker of distinction? He says, whatever you have done to these, the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. We cannot even achieve the spirituality or the character development until we take the time intentionally to connect. You know, in Revelation chapter 14, the apostle says that the 144,000, that special group of people that are going to be saved at last in the end time, the apostle says that they follow the Lamb where? Wherever he goes. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. And where do we find the Lamb? We find him visiting the homes of the poor, the sick, those who are cast out by society. We find him ministering to the broken. We find him touching the untouchable. That is where we find the Lamb. And that is what God has called us to do. But to get to that point, we need to first connect with the Lamb himself. And this is my last quote, and I'll close with this. An intensity such as never before was seen, and this is from Ellen White, is taking possession of the world. You see that intensity that is taking possession of the world, in amusement, in money-making, in the contest for power, in the very struggle for existence, there is a terrible force that engrosses body and mind and soul. In the midst of this maddening rush, God is speaking. He bids us come apart and commune with him. What does he say? Be still and know that I am God. God is calling each one of us to be still. Many, even in their seasons of devotion, fail of receiving the blessing of real communion with God. They are in too great haste. With hurried steps, they press through the circles of Christ's loving presence, pausing perhaps a moment within the sacred precincts, but not waiting for counsel. They have no time to remain with the divine teacher. With their burdens, they return to their work. And how Christ yearns, he says, come to me, all you who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Who labor and are heavy laden, I will take my yoke upon you. For my yoke is easy, my burden is light. So Christ is yearning to take those burdens, but so often we run into his presence and we run out and we're still carrying those same burdens. These workers can never attain the highest success until they learn the secret of strength. They must give themselves time to think, to pray, to wait upon God for a renewal of physical, mental, and spiritual power. They need the uplifting influence of his Spirit. Receiving this, they will be quickened by fresh life. The wearied frame and tired brain will be refreshed. The burdened heart will be lightened. Not a pause for a moment in his presence, but personal contact with Christ, to sit down in companionship with him. This is our need. And when we do, we will get off of our knees. We will come back amongst the people in our daily communion, and we will say, I have something to share with you. I have received the bread of life, the light of heaven, the water that will quench your thirst, and I can't wait to share it with you. That's what God has called us to do. In a world that is starving for connection, he's called each one of us to be a light bearer, to point people to that source of connection, that source of strength, that source of healing. And it starts on our knees, and it starts in our families, and then it goes from there. May God bless you.